The Vikings got back on track on Sunday night, and the Packers might be sunk. Plus, how the Colts keep on rolling, the Seahawks win their way, the Jaguars and Bills brawl in Buffalo, and what went wrong for the Steelers in Denver. We've got all that and so much more from Week 12 on the MMQB Monday Morning NFL Podcast. Hello and welcome to the MMQB Monday Morning NFL Podcast. I am Gary Gramling. He is Andy Benoit. And Andy, this is our favorite week of the year because we have wrapped up the bye weeks now. Everything is usually so even, though, except those teams that tied are still... It's a real...
So you like it for
really
the standings.
Really sticking in my craw.
Yeah,
for the standings,
like it
Because...
If I'm being honest, I dread when the bye weeks end because that means I'm watching film through Saturday again. It means these shows are longer. It takes longer to write the pre. It's a lot of NFL games being played when there are no bye weeks. I would be all for an 18-week season with 17 games and two byes for each team, but that's an off-season discussion.
Yeah, I don't know why they don't just do that, and then you'd get rid of all the quick turnarounds on Thursday Night Football. Seems all a little bit too logical to happen. But this is usually, again, those teams that have the ties, it's driving me nuts when I'm trying to do these playoff scenarios, which is what I obsess over this time of year. But we had a bunch of good games this week, and we're gonna talk about all of them. Hope everyone had a great Thanksgiving. Let's go with the Sunday night game. This is the Vikings beating the Packers. Let's start positive here. Vikings look good in this one. More play action, which is what I had demanded a week ago, and they end up rolling up 416 yards on a Packers secondary that is it's in rough shape right now.
You know, a Packers defense that's in rough shape. They were without Mike Daniels in this game. Nick Perry has really not been an impact player, but when you take him out of the lineup, now Kyler Fackrell's more of an every-down guy, and you've diminished your depth and some of the explosiveness off the bench, and we saw that in this game. And then in the secondary, yes, injuries have factored in. And right now it feels like it's Jari Alexander and then a bunch of guys that they're trying to play around. And Minnesota went after them tonight. The problem with Minnesota is they've got two number one receivers, and you need more than just Jari Alexander against them.
You do. You know, I was watching this game throughout and just saying, you know, Packers need a break. They need, like, you know, they need to fall on a fumble. They need some sort of Kirk Cousins miscommunication, throws an interception. And it just didn't come. Vikings did not make that mistake. Packers made that mistake and ended up costing them a timeout and a full minute on that Tremont Williams misplayed punt late in the game. But Vikings really efficient in this one. Nice performance. Packers offense, Andy. You know, another uneven game from them. They looked good early, and they did nothing in the second half.
And I think there are a variety of reasons for that, and we can delve into them. It felt like Kirk Cousins was going to be on schedule tonight, didn't it, Gary? And they talked earlier in the show about Mike Zimmer calling Cousins on Monday, hey, is the offense too complex? And Cousins saying, no, these interceptions are on me. My sense was there was a discussion between John DeFilippo and Cousins and Zimmer about, okay, what do we do well? Let's start there and build from there and get our rhythm back. And that's the kind of thing you don't see from this Green Bay offense. Let me ask it this way. If the Packers were to try to reestablish their rhythm on offense, we saw what the Vikings did tonight and what that meant for them and some of their play designs. What would it look like for Green Bay if they decided they wanted to do that?
I don't know. I think they're just caught in between this year. You know, you lost all those veteran receivers. You have all these rookies in there. And on top of that, what you know, you can't do just the Sandlot thing with Aaron Rodgers at this point. If you ever could do it as sort of a full-time approach, you need to scheme these guys open a little bit more. And it's not fitting what Aaron Rodgers does, and they just don't have the veteran guys that they have. This transition came quicker than I think anyone thought it might.
There's not a lot of marriage with their run game and pass game, and that stood out to me because they did commit to the running game a little bit more. Aaron Jones was a big part of their scripted plays. I thought he ran well. Their offensive line was moving the line of scrimmage at times, but it didn't lead into anything. It didn't manifest anything. it feels too often with Green Bay like you're watching a series of just individual plays. And when they had James Jones and Jordy Nelson and those kind of veteran guys that knew how to uncover late in the down, it worked out fine. But when they've got these different receivers in there now, younger guys, the structure needs to be built around them. I think we talked last week on the show, Gary, I do think Mike McCarthy has adjusted more than people are giving him credit for, but there's not a lot of chemistry with how the quarterback and the coach are relating in that regard. In other words, they're scheming stuff, but you never know what you're going to get with Rodgers. A lot of times it's more good than bad, but it's that never knowing that has a bigger impact on the aggregate. It's not just Rodgers out there being a magician. You have to have people out there who are comfortable playing with a magician. And Jordy Nelson was, James Jones was, Randall Cobb, when he's been healthy, he's been one of those guys. But these other guys are not, and most players are not, and it's hard to build an offense that way.
Yeah, I mean, you're seeing it all come home to roost a little bit this year for the Packers. I will make this one real quick on the Vikings side of it. They got off to a pretty rocky start in this game. It was kind of nice to see them sort of everything clicked into place, because those first two drives, I mean, they had trouble getting the call in on the fourth and one that they lined up to go for on the first drive. And then the second drive ended on that miscommunication between Cousins and Aldrick Robinson. That was a three and out, and you kind of wondered, is this going to carry over from last Sunday night? Is this going to be another ugly week for the Vikings offense? And they got it going nicely.
It's the difference between playing at home and playing against an average defense versus playing on the road against a dominant Bears defense at this point.
And one more thing I'll say, because I'm incredibly stubborn about this. I thought NBC put up the graphic, Packers 3% chance at making the postseason. I don't think the Packers are going to make the postseason. I've been saying they were going to run the table, win their last seven and make the Super Bowl, or win seven of the last eight and make the Super Bowl. I will not stick to that prediction anymore. However, I'm not going to count them out of this. They have five games left. They will be heavy favorites in four of them. They would have to go win at Chicago. If they get to 9-6-1, they could get there. Then you're looking at, if you're going to say they're not going to catch Minnesota, you'd need the Panthers and the Seahawks to lose twice each. Panthers still have to play the Saints twice. Seahawks host the Vikings, host the Chiefs. There's a path for the Packers to get there. It's not probable, but I feel like it's significantly more statistically possible than 3%, like 8%. Let's say that.
8%. You got to factor in that NFC East. We forget about them because it's not top heavy, but 6-5 Dallas, 6-5 Washington. Someone is in a wild card contention in that scenario, and Philadelphia is just a game back of those guys.
I'm going to be a jerk and count Washington out, which probably, considering the history of the show and what teams do when we count them out, that's usually a good thing. Eagles have a tough stretch run here. Eagles still have to go to Los Angeles, they go to Dallas. They have to play at Washington, the finale. They host the Texans. They have a tough schedule down the stretch here.
But if I'm the Eagles, that's the schedule I want. I get to play Dallas and play Washington. Doug Peterson could almost sell to them that you guys control your own destiny.
But boy, I mean, that's a gauntlet. They got to go. They got to go short week because they play Monday night next week, home against Washington. They got to travel to Dallas on a short week, and then they got to travel to Los Angeles right after that. That's rough.
Yeah, I know, but I'm talking about how the locker room's going to react to that. They'll take that us against the world approach.
I suppose so. They are the defending world champs. All right, let's go on Miami at Indianapolis. We do have an Eagles game to talk about later in the show. I feel like we just ate up a lot of Eagles time here. We're going to Miami at Indianapolis right now. Colts had to come back and win this one. This was a battle. No Ryan Kelly in this one for the Colts, and he's been such a big part of that really vastly improved offensive line for Indianapolis. But this one was close. Colts had to come back and win it. They end up kicking a last-second field goal by Adam Vinatieri, makes it 27-24 for a final. I don't know. Where do you stand with this Colts offense right now, Andy?
Very bullish. And to kind of tie it back to the Mike McCarthy discussion with Aaron Rodgers and what does their offense look like if they have to fall back on an identity, the Colts are the perfect illustration of quarterback and coach meeting in the middle. Frank Reich comes in, says, hey, Andrew Luck, you got a bad shoulder. You can't keep taking the hits. We're going to adjust the offense and go to more three-step timing. Ball is going to be out quickly. But here's the good part. We've drafted a bunch of really talented offensive linemen for you. We think they'll get better over the course of the year. We think you'll get more comfortable. And as the season evolves, we're going to remain a quick strike offense, but we are going to give you opportunities to extend plays and do what makes you, I think, in my opinion, a future Hall of Famer. And we've seen it go exactly like that. Luck has played with discipline, and he's played on schedule. And when that hasn't been enough, he has appropriately extended plays and found guys late in the down. He does it from within the pocket because that offensive line has been stellar. They're using Eric Ebron as a matchup piece. They've got three different running backs who are all these lightning bug type of guys. Naheem Hines, Marlon Mack, and then Josh Wilkins. Two of those guys are rookies. It's a really good offensive equation, and the scheme fits the personnel.
Jordan Wilkins, by the way. My guy.
What did I say?
Jordan Wilkins.
What did I say?
Josh Wilkins? Yeah. It happens.
And I was rolling there, too.
Jordan Wilkins. That was a good spiel.
It was. But you know who's really impressed me this year? It's Denver's Philip Lindsay, I think, and Matt Breida for the Niners, these jitterbug-type runners.
Yep.
And I think they fit today's NFL. Austin Eckler's another one of those guys.
Agreed.
The Colts have three of those.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, I love Adam Gase. I think you love Adam Gase, too. Everyone loves Adam Gase. I'm not gonna make this everyone get the pitchforks out for Adam Gase on this one. I hated the 3rd and 10 call. I know they were deep in their own territory.
Mm-hmm.
3.5 minutes left to run the ball on that play and basically say we're gonna punt it and give the ball to Andrew Luck at midfield and try to find a path to victory in a tie game that way was disappointing to me.
I agree with you 100%. Adam Gase, I've had a lot of chance to watch football and learn from Adam Gase. He's been very good to me. And his knowledge of the passing game and the way he thinks about it, it's so much more expansive than you would guess. He is a really good downfield passing game designer. So you're right. I do think highly of him because I've seen behind the curtain. I know how good he is. I would even say to him in our meetings, when I'm the one sitting there as the pupil, I would say I think he's way too conservative on third down and long. And I thought it was a problem last year. They were a little bit of a different offense last year, so I understood it a little more. But that was not the only third down call. I had in my notes watching this game today, Gary, probably 4 or 5 times where I thought Gase was super conservative on third down. They converted the first one. It was a swing pass to Kenyon Drake out of the backfield. So that kind of created the illusion of success, or I guess it was mm-hmm. genuine success, but it was still a conservative call. There were so many times. If it's 3rd and 8 or longer, there are so many occasions each week where it feels like Gase scales back and it's a screen. He loves quick screens out of trips on 3rd down and long. And in this case, he went all the way to running the ball. I agree that they handed the game to Luck, but they should have thrown the ball there. Quite, I mean, it's simple as that. They should have kept playing aggressively, even though they were backed up, because Indy was just 2 first downs away from field goal position if they had a good punt, if the Dolphins had a good punt.
I would have loved a shot there. I thought a shot would have been completely unexpected at that point. And well, not completely unexpected. It was 3rd and long, but we'll get to a team that that took a shot at an unexpected time and had it work on Sunday. One other play I didn't care for, Andy. That 4th and 1 pass to Andrew Luck from Jacoby Brissett to Andrew Luck in the second quarter. He took such a hit on that.
He did, but I thought that was a brilliant play by Brissett. That was not a called
yes.
pass. That was a
yep.
run play, and Minkah Fitzpatrick knew that, and he's the guy that's he played right corner all game. He's moved outside. He's not a slot guy right now. He's an outside corner, and so he's over Luck, and he figures they're not going to throw to Luck, so he blitzed, and
yep.
I don't know if that was the call. My guess is he did it on his own. Mm-hmm. Brissett saw that, and he threw the ball because Luck was totally uncovered. I understood it. I thought it was great awareness by Brissett.
I thought it was a good play by Fitzpatrick to I agree with you. I think it was probably something he did on his own. I thought it was a great play by Fitzpatrick, a heads-up play by Brissett, but I don't know, for that play to end up being Andrew Luck making a contested catch is
No, you have to – yeah, no, I'm with you, but you have to admit this. Andrew Luck elevated better than you would have guessed. And when he landed, there was a springy. He looked athletic on that play.
Yeah.
That was a he caught the ball in the air.
No, he's an athlete. That didn't surprise me that much.
Yeah,
I think
but
he was gonna Tom Brady that.
Right. Tom Brady's very clunky out in space. But Luck, I knew he's an athlete. I knew he's a mover. But I haven't seen him have to jump before. He jumped pretty well. And that's a big jumping's a big part of athleticism. Not if you're a quarterback, but if we're just trying to gauge who's an athlete and who's not. I can't jump for a game. Can you jump? You don't look like you could jump either.
No. I'm a very low to the ground. By the way, that is the mildest take you've ever had. Jumping is a big part of athleticism.
Oh, well, thank you. Somebody told me my mildest take ever was a tweet about 4 years ago where I said, LeSean McCoy has excellent lateral agility. That was all the tweet said.
That's
and
pretty mild,
I know what
too.
Was happening. I was mindlessly copying and pasting my notes into Twitter as I went along watching the film, and I just didn't. I didn't realize that was an anti-tweet.
That's kind of what Twitter is for. That should be the level of discourse on Twitter. I think the world would be a better place if people just tweeted short, factual statements. Non-controversial. This is a truth in the world. Let's go to Seattle at Carolina. This was, the Seahawks are winning games exactly how they want to win games. This was another one today. I just want to make a point because a lot of times I come on the show and I say, this team kind of caught a break. The team they beat got into the red zone X amount of times. It didn't score. Twice the Panthers went to the red zone against Seattle and didn't score, but both times Seattle made plays to make that happen. They stopped Cam Newton on a 4th-and-2 early on. Bradley McDougal made a tremendous interception in the end zone in the second half. That ended up being that's what kept them close, and they hung around. Russell Wilson made two huge plays in this one. One was on a 4th-and-3 from 35 yards out. They passed on the long field goal. They were down a touchdown at the time about midway through the fourth quarter. They ended up throwing. Panthers were banged up in the secondary. They had David Moore up against Corn Elder, the tremendously named rookie, and who had a really tough day. And David Moore beat him for a touchdown. And then just a great play to set up the game-winning field goal. Graham Gano had missed a 54-yarder. Seahawks came back. Wilson extended a play within the pocket. Basically broke down a Panther zone. Panthers had to go zone at that point because they had so many young guys in the secondary. And he ends up hitting Tyler Lockett for a long gainer, setting up the winning Sebastian Janikowski kick. This is exactly how you'd think the Seahawks would have won games this year if they were going to be in the playoff hunt, which obviously they very much are.
You know, David Moore, the wide receiver, there are teams. The Rams, for example, put Marcus Peters on him at times. I think teams view David Moore, and some of that's about the way Seattle uses their other guys and the way the Rams use Peters in this case. But I think teams around the league view David Moore a little higher than we would on the outside. So just a guy to keep in mind. What's also interesting about Seattle, because it's their offense that's fascinated me this year, Gary, and I think their defense has improved a lot. Trey Flowers at corner has improved a lot, and there's been a domino effect down from him because they no longer have the weak spot in their secondary to hide and have teams attack. But their offense is what has fascinated me because they play out of three receivers about 70% of the time, and yet they're a smash-mouth power-running offense that also plays with six offensive linemen. George Fant, and another athlete who can jump, the former basketball player, left tackle, he plays as the sixth lineman off the bench, and he's lately getting about 23 snaps a game or so. He's getting about a third of the snaps. So some of those snaps are coming in three receiver sets. It's a very unique combination, and I think they have struck the right balance with Russell Wilson. There's a lot to examine with the Seahawks and as how to evolve an offense and tailor it to your quarterback.
Yeah, and look, for the Panthers, this was a kind of like last week. You know, this was a game where the margin of error was very small, and they made just enough mistakes to come out of the wrong end of this one. Gano missed, as I mentioned, the 52-yarder that would have put the Seahawks up, or excuse me, would have put the Panthers up in the final minutes. And, other than that, they missed the fourth down. Cam Newton throws a red zone interception, and they just couldn't quite overcome it. It's a good team. They're not winning these games when they have a couple bounces go the other way.
And I think it's a team that should have a few more dominant defensive performances than they do every year. It seems like there are games that they just don't show up and they give up 30-something points. The Steelers game a few weeks ago is the most recent example. And that does not get balanced or counterbalanced by games where they just absolutely own the action. And they've got guys at front seven with those talented linebackers and that D-line. They should have games where they own the action.
Yeah, I mean, they lost Dante Jackson, the talented young cornerback, in this one early on, and they couldn't hold on the back end. That's sort of been a theme this year. Teams that are too injured in the secondary just can't contain opponents. Well, let's go to Pittsburgh at Denver. Broncos, they're right back in this thing. Broncos are for real, Andy. That's why we talked about it on the Thursday show.
We did, and I didn't know what you meant by for real, if we're saying they're really bad or really good, because they just beaten the Chargers to get to 4-6. They're now 5-6. I'm still not quite sure what you mean by for real. Are you still saying they're a 500 team, or are you saying they're the team that's beaten a couple of high, heavy hitters in the AFC the last 2 weeks?
I'm saying, according to Wikipedia, they're an organized football team in the National Football League, so... It's fantastic.
Is that the first sentence on their Wikipedia? That's not their Wikipedia
page. I'm sure it's something like that. But no, look, this is back-to-back impressive wins. You know, I mean, over the last 2 years, Vance Joseph seems to be sort of teetering on the edge of disaster, and his team plays for him. And I'm not going to say they necessarily outplayed the Steelers tonight. You know that thing I just said about how the Seahawks made plays in the red zone and that's how they stopped the Panthers? This was more of a, Xavier Grimble was going in for a long touchdown early on, and he ends up fumbling on the goal line at literally the very last moment. And instead of the ball trickling out of bounds at the 6-inch line, it trickles on the other side of the pylon, and then the Broncos get their touchback that way. James Conner lost another fumble. James Conner's having some ball security issues at this point. And, they blocked a field goal. Roethlisberger threw a game-ending interception when the Steelers had it down inside the 5-yard line with a chance to tie it. So, nice win for the Broncos. That's how I'll sum that up. They did get out gained by 200 something yards, but they get the win in this one.
Two things real quick. Wikipedia: the Denver Broncos are a professional American football franchise based in Denver, Colorado. So you weren't
American
too far
football.
Off.
American
the second thing is this was a balanced game. It was a close game throughout, and yet the Steelers ran the ball 16 times in the game. That's counting a couple of Roethlisberger runs, and they threw the ball 58 times. They dropped back over 60, a very unbalanced performance. We've seen them do that before, but they've done that against really formidable run defenses, like the Baltimore Ravens is the main one. I do think Denver is in that class of formidable run defense in terms of talent, but they don't always play that way, and I'm a little surprised that the Steelers didn't go after the Broncos on the ground a little bit more, given that this was a close game throughout.
Yeah, I will say this in the Steelers' defense. The plays were out there. I mean, there were a couple of throws that Roethlisberger left on the field where they were, they had guys running wide open downfield. They had a couple of near misses. This one could have been, it was not far away from being like a 40-something point performance by the Steelers' offense. I didn't have a big problem with what they did offensively. Just I had a problem with their ball security and the fact that they just kept on turning it over.
Well, and you make a good point. I guess I should add that they dropped back over 60 times, but they had over 460 yards passing. They did have a couple of interceptions, but they had the long touchdown. So I hear what you're saying. And a lot of times in teams that have these expansive screen games, which the Steelers do, especially with their wide receivers, that can be an extension of your running game. I guess just as a general moving forward point, Denver's run defense has been better. Those linebackers have been a lot more aggressive the last few weeks. I would still challenge the Broncos on the ground and make them defend the run through four base runs through four quarters. Pittsburgh has that in their arsenal. They go to heavy sets. They've got mobile guards, a very mobile center, and Pouncey. They're equipped to challenge and stress a run defense in a lot of ways. So just something to keep in mind. But I'm not officially issuing a criticism here. I hear what you're saying completely.
And this was, you mentioned him earlier in the show, so we'll bring him up here. Philip Lindsay was really good in this game, 14 for 110. And I got to say, he fits through creases. He's a small guy, but he fits through incredibly small creases. I mean, there were three or four times during this game where I almost started to look away because there was clearly nowhere for him to go, and then all of a sudden he pops through and he's got 8 yards.
The ability to fit through small cracks is a big deal in the NFL. Frank Gore has made his entire career off of that. And Lindsey is a small guy, but he doesn't play small. He's not easy to tackle. When I think of small guys, I think of how easy do they go down. He's got a little bit of that Alvin Kamara, and they're totally different types of runners. But theoretically, he's an agile runner who can also break tackles. That's what Lindsey is, and Kamara is the best in the NFL in that regard.
All right, let's go east. Let's talk Giants at Eagles. The champs stay alive, kind of just barely in this one. They fell down 19-3 late in the first half. They had to rally. They end up winning it on a Jake Elliott field goal, just like they beat the Giants at home last year back in week three. This one was a more reasonable kick, not the 60-something yarder. 25-22 is the final. Eagles had the same issues on the back end that they've had. I guess the one thing that people are going to talk about from this game is the Giants just didn't give the ball to Saquon Barkley in the second half of the game, which kind of confused everyone. It was a lot of I don't want to say a lot of Wayne Gallman on the field, but more Wayne Gallman than you would have expected. Barkley had this monster first half, and he came out and he had 5 touches in the second half as this lead sort of slipped away from the Giants. I don't know what else to say about it.
Well, I thought you were going to talk about the Odell Beckham part, where his quote after the game that knowing the Eagles were struggling with injuries in the secondary, personally, I would have loved to attack them, but that wasn't in our game plan. That's the one that's making headlines, is you got Beckham grumbling a little bit about the approach. And you have to go back and you have to watch the film on this kind of thing to see how, okay, are they actually attacking them? Why are they not getting the ball downfield? But let's just take it at face value. Beckham raises a great point. The Eagles are more banged up in the secondary now than any team I've seen in probably the last 5 years. I watched their film last week and felt like I'd almost wasted my time. It was a Saints game.
Yep.
Why even watch this? Because they've got so many backup players in the secondary.
Yeah, I would give this defense of the Giants' game plan. They can't block the Eagles. It was not a complete disaster, but
Eagles
front four put pressure on them. That had not been the case, last week against New Orleans or anything like that. I mean, that necessarily limits what you're going to do, and not to mention the fact that they were up 19-3 in this game.
And so my guess is Eli Manning prefers to have all of his receivers that were eligible out in routes, because just about every coach has had some form of a five-down protection team with Manning, and they don't keep extra bodies in to help pass block. Theoretically, it raises the question, should you do that when you go up against an opponent that is so ravaged in the secondary? Now, in Philly's case, they might just bring green dog blitzes if you pass block. In other words, if I'm Nigel Bradham at linebacker and I've got the running back in man coverage and that running back blocks, I might just become a blitzer. So maybe you're inviting more pressure on Manning. But typically when you keep extra guys in to protect, you get vertical routes downfield. And I know last week, for example, that Buccaneers game that the Giants played, there were several instances where the Giants did do that, and Beckham was open later in the down, and Manning didn't quite let it fully unfold. And so just the themes we've talked about the Giants all season long, I guess, Gary, we can both agree they're in play here. It's, are they being aggressive enough? Is Manning being aggressive enough? Do they have an offensive line that even allows them to be aggressive enough?
Yeah. I'm surprised. I had not. I guess I didn't do my research well enough. I did not know that Beckham quote coming into our taping here. I was a little bit surprised to hear that. But
well, I'll break news for you on the show here, Gary.
Come
to me, the guy that watches this on DVR, for instant updates.
We don't break news to anyone listening to the show. We just break news to each other every once in a while. That's how it goes here. Let's go Cleveland at Cincinnati. Look, I think I'm just done piling on Hugh Jackson at this point. It's it's easy. It feels gratuitous at this point. So I'm not going to get into it too much. He's supposed to be sort of consulting for the defensive side of the ball, you would think, and I realize he wasn't in on the install sessions this summer and all that, but you'd think he'd have some sort of intel to share with the Bengals about the Browns personnel that would have given them some kind of, not huge edge, but enough of an edge to not be completely gutted in this game, and that was not the case. Browns jump out to a big lead. They're up 28-0 halfway through the second quarter, and they cruise to a victory in Cincinnati, the Browns' first road victory since October 2015. So things are looking up and up there. But there had been a report this morning that Hugh Jackson might be viewed as the heir apparent to Marvin Lewis in Cincinnati, and that's why they brought him back there. They liked the work he did with Andy Dalton when he was there. Look, owners can do whatever they want. They own the team.
The Browns, a division rival, would welcome Hugh Jackson being the Bengals' next head coach.
Yeah, that's it. We're not going to insult Hugh Jackson anymore.
I don't know. I mean, you don't think he kind of earned it by going on his – I heard somebody refer to it. He went on that whirlwind of interviews after he was fired, and there was some kind of pointing and, you know, he didn't take full blame for everything that went on in Cleveland. Even though no coach deserves full blame, it's kind of unwritten rule. You're still supposed to take full blame. I heard one person refer to that as it's career suicide by interview is what Jackson was doing after that. But here we are just a few weeks later, and I guess he's either that or he's got a great agent. His name's on the coaching search list already.
My argument is I've done the calculus on this. So like I've done all the, I broke out the graphing calculator and I charted everything out. I think we balanced it out. I think that ridiculous farewell tour he went on, I think he's been piled on enough. I think we reached the saturation point with that.
Does it raise your eyebrows at all that, and look, the guys who are talking, Demarius Randall, I guess, presented him with a game ball facetiously after an interception. Demarius Randall, he's been like that before. And then Baker Mayfield criticized him with an indirect, very direct slash, shot across the basically his face with the we've got play callers we believe in now.
Yeah.
Does it raise your eyebrows at all that the players are some of the players are doing that to Jackson?
The only thing that was kind of surprising is the guy got fired. It's not like I felt like there was an element with the Browns of, you know, oh, that guy joined the other team or something like that.
Yeah,
as if like
right.
Hugh Jackson left the Browns voluntarily. He might have told the team that he was leaving voluntarily, and maybe that's part of the problem. But it, you know, like this was his choice. He went over to Cincinnati, and he wanted to, you know, that was his big scheme or something like that. Where it's like, no, he got fired, and then someone said, "We'll give you a paycheck," and he said, "Okay."
Yeah, no, I agree. I just it's worth floating. It's so interesting. You don't see coaches get ripped by their own their former players like that quite. So I don't know. It'll be interesting to see what happens with Hugh. I've heard he's an offensive coordinator candidate for some teams as well. People like him as a schemer, I guess.
Yeah, if you got him the right veteran quarterback, I guess. I wouldn't put him in there with a young guy again after how it went with Deshaun Kizer 2 years ago. Just one more quick mention on the Browns here. You know, we had talked, they had the bye week last week. 2 weeks ago, they went with a real smash-mouth approach in beating the Falcons. And they were a little more diverse today. They spread it out. They threw it around a little bit. So they are building some things on top of what they had done in the Falcons game and for half of the Chiefs game before that. So things are looking up. Things are looking good for the Browns right now. Don't know if it's a playoff year, but you certainly should be excited for the future if you are a Cleveland fan. Let's go to the Jaguars and the Bills.
Careful, Gary. Calm down. Don't get out of hand.
I know. I'm just so glad to talk about the Bills again. It's been so long. I will say, look, we had the brawl in this game, and Leonard Fournette should really. I mean, he shouldn't throw punches anyway because the Jaguars need him. But don't throw punches at a guy who is wearing a helmet when you're not wearing a helmet. That's a doubly bad idea. The other thing I'll say,
it's being a man. I think he's being a man when he does that, Gary. A man who lets down his team in crunch time, no less. That takes even more manhood. To get yourself ejected for a below-average defensive lineman on the other team when you're the star running back, I think that's really being a man, stepping up and getting kicked out.
The fact that the karma, I don't know if it's karma, the comeuppance came so fast in that, because they were first yeah. in goal on like the 6-inch line, and I mean, look, it was a false start, so that's, you know, that might happen if Leonard Fournette is in your backfield anyway, but they back themselves up so quickly with a couple of penalties, and they end up missing a 42-yard field goal, and then the Bills just take the ball, and what, that was like a 3-play drive that Josh Allen needed to get the go-ahead score there. So that turned around so quickly. Fournette's got to be better than that, yes. I will say Josh Allen, he's incredibly green. He is surrounded by a not very good supporting cast. He made a couple of spectacular plays in this one. I still can't believe that touchdown throw to Robert Foster.
Oh,
because
man.
He was being swallowed up by three guys as he let that ball go.
75-yard touchdown under severe duress, knowing the hit is coming, releasing the ball as the hit is coming, and he throws a big-time spiral. I don't know how many air yards it traveled. It was a lot. It was probably the best. If we're isolating just the arm and taking out the legs, that's probably the best throw we've seen all season.
Yeah, it was incredible. And it was just shocking to see on the broadcast angle, because it looked like a sack. He had three black jerseys basically draped on him, converging on him, and all of a sudden that ball pops out of there. You would have thought it was like some sort of CGI glitch or something. I'll say this about Josh Allen, because I was on Toronto radio, and every time I'm on Toronto radio, they talk a lot of Bills, and they talk a lot about, Patrick Mahomes. You could have had Patrick Mahomes. And yes, the Bills should have taken Patrick Mahomes. Everybody should have taken Patrick Mahomes and should be kicking themselves over that. And I'm not about to argue that Josh Allen is in the same class as Patrick Mahomes, but I will say, Josh Allen is winning games thrown to guys like Robert Foster and Jason Kroom and Isaiah McKenzie. I don't
or
know
he's
what
won
Patrick
a game. He won this game. I mean, Josh Allen's been out for several weeks, and he was very up and down before the injury.
He won a game in Minnesota, Andy. That's still a win. Well, still a win.
You know what stood out in this game particularly to me, and I was surprised this wasn't a bigger factor early in the season, is Josh Allen can really run. His mobility is an asset, and I think he's in that. I don't think he's in the Cam Newton class for talent there. I think he's in the class. I think Cam Newton sits at the front of that class. Josh Allen probably sits in the middle rows, maybe near the back, but he's in that small classroom with Cam Newton of guys that can really hurt you with their legs. And the reason I bring up Newton is Allen can do it as a power runner. He's 245 mm-hmm. pounds, but there's some load behind his movement. He scrambled a lot in this game, which he's going to do because he doesn't always see things clearly. I thought the scrambles for the most part were appropriate, but there were some designed runs with him. He had a touchdown on a quarterback draw. The read options were not successful, but I love the concept. I love that they're using him in that way. They need to use Josh Allen almost the exact same way as the Panthers use Cam Newton. It's going to be a watered-down version because Allen's a few years away from running that kind of an expansive offense, but that's how it has to be. Josh Allen is the next Cam Newton if everything goes well.
I said that so much last spring, and I took so much crap for it. The last thing I'll say about this game, the Jaguars, and look, the Jaguars are not going anywhere even had they won this game. Andrew Norwell went out in this one, so they're done on the offensive line. I don't know what they can do offensively going forward. It was a lost season, and now it's a really lost season.
Well, and also with that note on their offensive line, because it absolutely humiliated the Bills in the first half of this game. They moved the line of scrimmage and just ran between the tackles for 10 to 12 yards every snap, it seemed like. And yet here they are losing the game. They did the same thing last week against Pittsburgh. They built a bit of a lead. What I've come to learn from Jacksonville I think your running game is only as good as the passing game that comes off of your running game. And if you're just going to ram the ball down the other team's throat, that's all good and well. But it's not going to win the game for you over the course of 60 minutes in today's NFL. You've got to have a passing game that relates to your running game, and it's got to be effective. And Jacksonville has that, but it hasn't been effective for them.
Let's go one more game for the lightning round. Let's go Tampa, San Francisco, 49ers come across country. The Bucs get the win. I think Nick Mullins has turned into a pumpkin at this point. Jameis Winston comes back, gets his victory. Vita Vea made a couple plays in this game. The increasingly maligned Bucs first round pick, because everyone there wanted Derwin James, and instead, they get the big run stuffer who made a couple plays today. But we're going to talk about the 49ers a little bit and their situation with Reuben Foster, who they ended up letting go. He was arrested, accused of domestic violence by his girlfriend. Again, this time was in the team hotel. They have moved on from him. They stuck by him last time. The charges end up being dropped. We'll see how this one plays out in the criminal justice system as far as Foster's future goes, but he is done in San Francisco.
This is a big story, Gary. I don't know what happened with Foster, and that's a very serious situation. We'll leave it at that. So we're talking just football here, and remove the personal stuff for a minute. Reuben Foster is one of the most talented young linebackers to come into the NFL in quite a while. He looks different on film. He jumps off the screen. So to cut a guy like that tells you two things. One, it's going to be some interesting conversations around the NFL about should we sign him, should we not sign him, and what's that mean for the fan base, and all that comes with that. And number two is those off-field issues and the Niners, I don't care what they're saying. I'm sure they know more than what we realize that they know. They always do. The teams know this stuff. They know what's going on. See, people in the police department are honest with these guys behind the scenes about what's happening. This, to cut a player that talented, it's got to be bad. There's got to be some real big concerns there with that guy.
He had concerns coming out of Alabama. Robert Klemko wrote a piece on Reuben Foster for us back during the draft process. He's a guy who had and none of this is to excuse his behavior. He's a guy who had a very hard upbringing. Football is probably his only way, really his only way to making a living in life at this point. He's 24 years old, and look, details will come out. Teams will make their decisions on it. He is supremely talented, but this is unacceptable. It's incredibly sad for the victim, and if this is it, he kind of did this to himself. Let's get it back to football for the lightning-ish round here. Let's go Oakland, Baltimore. The Ravens get another victory with Lamar Jackson under center. This one, they did not run Lamar Jackson 27 times. This one, he only ran it 11 times. They end up as a team running it 43 times for 242. This is still, he's such a difference maker in the ground game. They did a little bit more through the air. He did throw two interceptions. I feel like this is a team that can, with the ground game and with the threat of that ground game, they can eke out a couple of big plays in the passing game. He had one long 74-yard pass to Mark Andrews in this one, sort of a catch and run. He had another similar play that actually got called back on a penalty. So I don't know. I think he's got to get one more start at least.
The fact that they had 242 yards rushing, as you said, on 43 runs, and I know he was only 71 of those yards, but the threat of his mobility changes the equation for everybody else. We talk about it all the time. I see my guy Ty Montgomery had 8 runs for 51 yards. It doesn't look like it's something a guy in 88 would be doing, does it, Gary? he did have 3 catches for 13 yards, though. A long of 6. Imagine what Michael Irvin's turning over in his grave that his number's being worn by this guy. But Jackson does have to get another start because of the dimension it brings to the running game and how it skews things for the offense. It's the fact that he ran so much in that first game, that's got everybody terrified now who has to defend him, because the one thing you don't want to see as a defense, even though it's also ironically the one thing you don't want to have to rely on as an offense, is a quarterback who can beat you with his legs.
Yeah. Ty Montgomery, by the way, had split out a couple of times in this game, which I think will give you some inner peace, Andy. But
Not a bit of interest. He ran the ball eight times. He ran it very well. Eight times, 51 yards, long of 15. That's a sustainable back. That, to me, Gary, looks like a powerful, chains-moving, ground-eating running back.
He's got to wear John Riggins 44 or something like that going forward. Cut that number in half. I don't know if someone else wears 44 for the Ravens right now, but give it to Ty Montgomery. Yeah, interesting little thing here. If Lamar Jackson gets the start next week, they do go on the road. That's something of a different challenge. It is that Atlanta defense that has struggled. We'll see if Deion Jones is back. And then another road game. That one's at Kansas City. So there's no world-beating defenses coming up here for the Ravens. So I don't know. I think they keep on riding this and see how it goes. Patriots get sort of everyone back. They're getting healthier. Not really a dominant performance in New York here. They beat the Jets 27-13. The Jets did hang around in this one. It was tied at 13 midway through the third quarter before the Patriots pulled away. But I don't know. Gronkowski caught a long touchdown. There were some good moments for the Patriots here.
Yeah, whatever. It's another Patriot game. I'm going to use this opportunity to say that I think the Bears coaches film is no longer my least favorite coaches film. I think it's the New York Jets home games.
Yeah?
Because the camera is up so high and tilted at such a weird angle. And when the light hits the Jets field, which it often does because they play at 1 o'clock so much, and it's also not a high-quality camera. They don't have the same HD as a team like the Falcons has. It's all so blurry. You can't tell who's who out there at times. And I am dreading watching this film because I'm going to have to watch the Jets and try to figure out, is that Jermaine Kearse out there at wide receiver or is that Quincy Enunwa? I can't tell. That's my rant.
All right. It's a good rant. Last game of the week. This is Arizona at the Chargers. This was Phillip Rivers set an NFL record, 25 consecutive completions. Now that's a record for any single game. Those 25 were to start this game, so he was 25 for 25 at one point. Ended up a 28 for 29 performance. He should have taken more sacks. He should have thrown nothing but shovel passes in the fourth quarter since his game was out of reach. The Cardinals actually they jumped out front early. They were winning this game 10-0 after the first quarter, and then it was a 45 unanswered points for the Chargers, and Geno Smith got to see a little action in the fourth quarter.
You know, this 45-point, this should not be happening in Arizona. I picked them to go 4-12. I knew it was a rebuilding effort. They do not have a rebuilding defense. It's not a bad defense. This is now, after today, at least in this performance, you say this is a grossly underachieving defense, and we could do a long segment on another day about all the reasons behind that.
One more, actually, kind of big note from this game. Melvin Gordon with what is being reported at the moment as an MCL injury in this game. So they might be without him for a couple of weeks here. They go to Pittsburgh next week, which is going to be a tough game. But it looks like it's going to be a lot of Austin Eckler and probably the rookie Justin Jackson filling in some combination. I would guess Eckler is going to get the bulk of the work here.
He brings a nice dimension to their offense. I hope Gordon's healthy. You want to see the best players out there on the best teams. But I already talked earlier in the show. I forget what game it was in, but somehow Austin Eckler's come up, and everybody knows I love the guy.
Austin Eckler's awesome. He's really cool. And Robert Klumko has a really good Twitter thread out there about how he got discovered if you just want to search Twitter. I'm not going to find it for you. Andy, thing of the week. You got anything?
I'll let you go first again.
I'll go first. I feel like I kind of touched on everything that I wanted to mention for Thing of the Week. So I will go with red zone turnovers. I don't know if there's been more this year.
Come on. Red zone again?
Yeah, red zone again. It's always red zone. It's all about the red zone. That is swinging so many games. Because for some reason, it's not that there's a lot of red zone turnovers. It feels like they're coming in bunches for team. The Falcons on Thursday night end up with three red zone turnovers. I mean, these are fumbles. These are lost fumbles. These are really weird, fluky plays that are turning a lot of games. Not that the Falcons were going to beat the Saints if they hadn't fumbled, but yeah, it's a weird thing. And we're talking about, you know, upsets and how it's such a you know, fine line between victory and defeat in this league. And that is swinging a ton of games this year. I'm going to chart how many, but right now it feels like a lot. It's not much of a thing, but that's my thing.
No, it's a good thing. It really is. I'm going to go with three-level stretches. And a three-level stretch is when you have a receiver go deep, another one go intermediate, and another one go shallow, all on the same side of the field. The Vikings did it really well against the Packers. It's a John DeFilippo special. Their offensive coordinator, he loves the concept. It comes a lot. I mean, everybody does it, but Philadelphia, where DeFilippo was, they were very good at it. It's a staple of theirs. It's a staple of the Chiefs. The Rams get into it. The best offenses stress you at three levels, and it's a zone beating tactic, and it beats every single zone out there. It can, because you're flooding one side of the zone. There's no zone coverage that plays with three levels of defenders. There's only zone with two deep or one guy deep and one guy underneath. That's the nature of all zone coverage in some way or another. So anyway, it's a really great tactic, and we're seeing more of it, more creative ways to get to it. The Vikings had some really creative formations to get to it in this game tonight.
Good. Good thing.
My other thing is going to be that I like the Thanksgiving graphics that CBS does as they come, you know, they show the score and they come in and out of the break. They have little cornucopias or stuff. That was going to be my thing. But then you said red zone, which is why I threw my objection up, because now I have to take it seriously. And so I thought, all right, well, three-level stretches. But I also love how they do the – I wish they'd do that more often. I'd like to see some Christmas graphics up next week.
It is that time of year. And look, your thing can be a cornucopia anytime.
No, that is always acceptable. Thanksgiving time, let's not get carried away. Because that's the other thing I don't like is when this stuff gets done out of season. I went furniture shopping the other day, and they were playing Christmas music, and it's before Thanksgiving. And I'm guarantee you, Gary, I needed a couch bad. I came within seconds of storming out of the store and just forgetting the couch, because I don't like these holidays. People jumpstart these holidays rather than waiting and letting and embracing them when the time comes.
Here's my defense. Hanukkah is very early this year, so we're going to have an early holiday season. Thanksgiving was early too, so all this stuff got pushed up. And we put up the tree in our house. We're ready to go here.
Oh, I've got the tree. My football room is totally decked out in Christmas stuff. I do that the day after Thanksgiving. I get it done right away, early that morning, and I stay up late watching film because I spend all day decorating. So I'm with you on that. I'm talking about when this stuff happens before the holiday. The Christmas stuff did not go up on Wednesday before Thanksgiving in my house. It went up on Friday right after Thanksgiving, and that's the only way to do it.
Hmm. All right.
Ugh.
No. Considering. I'm considering your point.
When did you put up your tree is what I want to know.
We started digging it out because we have the fake tree. We stopped.
Yep. No, that's fine. Well, I've come around on those. I've got two of them, in fact.
It doesn't smell right, though. That's
I've got. I don't want to give them free advertising, but there is a certain candle you can get, a pine candle that I've learned to like more than actual pine smell itself.
Oh, maybe
but
we'll
go ahead.
With that. We didn't have it. We didn't have it up for decoration until it was either Friday or Saturday.
That's okay. Good. You and I are, we are simpatico.
I guess. All right. That's going to wrap it. We'll be back for the Thursday show. For now, thanks to researchers Reed Foster and Ryan Taylor for making it sound smart. Thanks to producer Shelby Royston and the guys at Cadence 13 who make us sound good every week. Most of all, thank you to you guys for listening to this episode of the MMQB Monday Morning NFL Podcast. You are the best. Deep dive show Thursday this week, back to the normal schedule. We will have the mini mailbag, so send those questions to talkback@themmqb.com. Or you can get us on Twitter, Andy_Benoit or GGrambling_SI. We're both on Facebook as well if you want to send questions there. To get our shows, as well as the MMQB podcast with Albert Breer featuring Jenny Brentis and Connor Orr, plus the MMQB gambling podcast hosted by myself, Jimmy Traina, and Scott Gramling, just subscribe to the MMQB NFL podcasts wherever you listen to podcasts, including the MMQB.com, SI.com, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, TuneIn, Radio.com, and other podcast providers. We'll see you guys on Thursday.
Tip of the hat to Albert, another strong edition of MMQB. Did you know your favorite team has a daily podcast on the Locked On Podcast Network? Steelers fans, we have you covered with Locked On Steelers. Cowboys fans, it's Locked On Cowboys. And Chiefs fans, it's Locked On Chiefs. You get the picture. Search Locked On, your favorite team. Search on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts for Locked On, your favorite team. Or tell your smart speaker to play podcasts Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.